I'm Naomi Lewin with a special WQXR podcast on the evolving situation at the New York City Opera. On July 12th at the Guggenheim Museum, New York City Opera announced its 2011-2012 season in a rather dramatic fashion. The plan is to move out of its longtime Lincoln Center home, formerly the State Theater, now the David H. Koch Theater, to perform five operas in venues around the city. And they include those venues, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, the Museo del Barrio, and John Jay College. Right before the City Opera announcement, union musicians gathered outside the Guggenheim in the broiling July heat to stage a lively demonstration against the move and against the cuts that will result from it. City Opera says the move is the only way to remain viable. Critics contend that the opera hasn't made necessary adjustments or taken appropriate steps to keep the company at Lincoln Center. Here to offer some perspective are three guests. Catherine Malfitano is a soprano who began her career at New York City Opera. She is also a stage director and a voice teacher at the Manhattan School of Music. James Jordan, on the phone, is editor of the opera blog Parterre Box, and Ken Benson is an artist manager, formerly with Columbia Artists Management. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to start with a clip of George Steele at the news conference, and please pardon, there were a few audio problems in gathering this clip.
For years, we've done pieces which maybe, which certainly weren't written for a theater the size that we performed them in, and we have a chance to address directly, to bring to New York City operas in the settings where they belong. And at the same time, we can bring New York City opera literally into the fabric of New York City itself. It will be a unique experience for artists and audiences alike, and I think it will continue to build on the tremendous artistic successes of the last 2 years.
James Jordan, I'm going to start with you, and I will add that you are also a columnist for the New York Post. James Jordan, did George Steele make his case effectively?
George Steele has come up with a brilliant solution for the wrong problem. What he's proposing would have been a brilliant solution for the so-called dark year the New York City Opera had several years ago when there were renovations being made to the New York State Theater. It would have been a brilliant public relations move and a way of keeping the company alive by going out into these alternative spaces during that year, which a number of opera companies have done when they've done renovations. The English National Opera a few years ago, the Deutsche Oper on London is doing right now. They're actually out of their home for 3 years and are playing in an alternative venue. So that would have been a great plan. I feel like what's happening now is trying to make a virtue of necessity, that because they, at least it's the assumption is that they can't afford to stay in Lincoln Center, they're having to move someplace else. And I don't know that that's a plan that's going to pay off in the long run. But I can leave it on to some of the other panelists to expand on that.
Catherine Malfitano.
I totally agree with what James has just said. It's absolutely pithy and to the target. The point is that this is a little too late. And what has actually happened here, and the public really is not informed, and nothing is being done to expose the incredible misappropriations of the funds. I mean, nobody's asking how did New York City Opera go from $55,000 to $60,000 worth of endowment down to $19,000. Nobody's asking for an accounting. So basically, the board has painted themselves. Board and George Steele at the moment, but this started before George Steele. But George Steele is continuing this. Both the board and George Steele have painted themselves into a corner, and now, as James Jordan says, they're making a virtue out of necessity. This was not a plan that was a vision all along. It is a desperate act at the last moment to see how they can keep this going. But it goes completely against the original mission of New York City Opera. It's a very clever way of masking the people's opera mission. Of course, things have to change in times of of fiscal difficulty. But to suddenly turn this around and say, we're going out to the people now, instead of the people having to come to us, is a razzle-dazzle way of taking us away from the main point. Why did we get here in the first place? Why wasn't there any dialogue or communication with all areas of the company way before this time?
Well, another question would be, why or how did somebody get David H. Koch to give so much money to renovate the State Theater when the company itself was on shaky ground? And why can't they
He wanted his name on the building.
And which would be why they can't get him to save the opera company now? Can you?
I think what's interesting is the theater, the State Theater, the David Koch Theater, has never been in better shape. That's what's so ironic. After the renovation, I think it looks better, and I think the acoustics are as good as they've ever been. I think that the acoustical problem has always been overrated. I think that became a cudgel used against City Opera. It may not have been perfect, but I don't think so many great singers could have built important careers there if the acoustics were as bad as later management led on. But I agree with everything both of my colleagues have said. I think as far as what Mr. Steele said, all operas are now being done in theaters larger than they were written for. That is just the way opera evolved. Theaters are bigger, but we've accommodated that a long time ago. I think two things make any kind of an arts company, a core company of human beings, solo artists, chorus, orchestra, administration, backstage, and a resident venue. And it doesn't mean they can't branch out once in a while. I think the idea of doing a show at the Delacorte next summer is a lovely idea. But it shouldn't be all an itinerant company. I don't know that an audience is going to travel all over the city to these different venues. I just was thinking last night the DaCapo Opera, which is a lovely opera that has a company that has their own theater on the east side, is doing 5 shows in one venue next year, thereby making them really more of a continuous resident company than City Opera will be.
Yeah, again, I think this is problematic, the idea that the way to solve a problem is to flee from your resident company. No company, this is a precedent, no company in the world has done this in a way to solve their problems. There are companies, too, like Baltimore, that died and now are being, they're raising themselves up like a phoenix. So that is also a possibility in this case.
James, please feel free to jump in because you're not here in the studio. So,
no, I think all, besides the symbolic value and I guess the public relations value of having a home venue, there's also the very practical problem that moving to a new theater, touring to a new theater, is a very expensive and labor-intensive enterprise. The company will have to load in these shows into the Brooklyn Academy of Music and then load them out. We'll have to load into El Museo del Barrio and then move out. There's also a problem that Alex Ross pointed out in his blog this morning. Where are all these shows going to be rehearsed if they're not using the Lincoln Center rehearsal spaces that were sort of a built-in part of City Opera's residency at New York at Lincoln Center? Where are they going to be rehearsing all of this? And I know, having worked a little bit with smaller opera companies and really infinitesimal opera companies here in the city, rehearsal space is one of the huge line items in any company's budget because it's just so expensive. It's a real estate issue.
But
so
presumably,
these are practical problems that need to be addressed. I I'm glad I'm not the one who has to address
right.
them.
I think we all are. I was going to say, presumably, the rehearsal space is, however much it costs, is going to be less expensive than the real estate expensive rental at Lincoln Center that they were paying, with which they were hoping to save money.
But I just want to direct our attention to that statement of George Steele for a moment. He's saying basically that these opera companies like the Koch Theater are now becoming too large for some of the operas they would like to bring to the people. But excuse me, La Traviata is done all over the world in the biggest theaters. He can't use that argument and then say we're going to take Traviata to the people, or Cozy, for that matter. My God, it's done it. Salzburg, it's done it. You know, Covent Garden, it's done it. Scala. I don't understand this argument. You can say that maybe for Telemann.
But also, Baroque opera had a huge revival at New York City Opera at the State Theater.
In a large theater. Yeah. So I don't really buy that as an argument.
I guess the argument is selling the number of seats as opposed to selling the number of seats in a smaller.
Well, selling the number of seats, is we have to look at other issues to understand why the seats aren't being sold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's get to the labor issues maybe, because the new plan is obviously setting out to drastically alter or tear up the
start at zero.
The current singers and orchestras' contracts with City Opera. Now, Catherine, you have called that simply shameful, but
no, I want to say that I read Julius Rudell's statement that he said it was shameful. I agree with him. But I'm not the only one. And, you know, I would like to correct one thing, because I'm in the forefront right now being a spokesperson for all the soloists who signed that letter. It's not me who is driving this.
Right, right, right. No, I understand that
you're representing. I'm standing as a representative voice. But what I want to say about that is right now, because of the fact that they have painted themselves into a corner where they are saying, this is where we are at right now. And they're turning around and saying that the unions are at fault. But let us remember a fact that has been written about, but it's very important to say over and over again. There was a concession agreement over the last 2 years. The orchestra conceded $5 million over 2 years, and many people conceded their fees. George Steele is still being paid at a very high rate.
Okay. Could I just finish the question, though? Because my question basically is, you can't run a company and pay union salaries on fumes. And it seems at this point that City Opera is running on fumes. So do the people you represent have a viable proposal to keep New York City Opera afloat?
Again, I think this is the wrong way around. We have to look at why did the board allow it to come to this place. They should be taking full responsibility for this situation.
Granted. Yeah, Ken?
I was going to say what troubles me so much in all of this is, as James said, this would have been a plan for an interim year. And if we think of this coming year as an interim regrouping salvage year, but there doesn't seem to be any inclination on the part of management or the board to regroup. In fact, to me, I get almost a sense of relief that this is now City Opera, and it really will be City Opera in name only. We can call it City Opera, but it's not going to be the company that's existed from the 1940s.
James, would you have does a viable solution occur to you to keep City Opera open as a repertory company?
Gosh, I'm so happy that I'm out of the impresario business, and I don't have to answer that kind of question anymore.
Does anybody?
I think the point is you either have to have a public or a really large amount of money coming in to support the company while the public builds. I don't think the public for the New York City Opera really is there anymore. And so the only real solution then is to showcase the company in a way that will pull the audience in. We'll get audiences excited about New York City Opera, and we'll build that public, you know, by two or threefold over 3 or 4 years to get a big solid public base again. And the only way to do that is to spend money. And if you don't have the money to spend, I don't know. You know, it's like, you know, there's no gas in the car to drive to the job, and you don't have a job, so you can't buy gas. So what are you going to do?
Well, playing devil's advocate here for a moment.
Play.
It does seem wrong that New York should not have more than one major opera company when London and Berlin do, but the companies in London and Berlin get great big government subsidies. And once again, playing devil's advocate, isn't the Met these days doing a lot of what City Opera used to do, giving opportunities to younger singers, presenting cutting-edge productions, bringing opera to the people with rush tickets and HD movie theater
Of course, that has contributed a great deal to the downsizing of the public for New York City Opera. But I don't think that the two companies are in competition in ideal terms. I think that still the Met represents a certain level of the types of artists that they employ, mostly a real huge mix of American and European artists.
It's
an international theater. And New York City Opera was mainly an American theater. I think that that's what is getting lost here, is that we have to preserve this American theater. It's not to say that the original mission that created New York City Opera has to stay exactly the same. We have to have the ability to be flexible and change with the times to some extent. But to suddenly disband a perfectly viable company may not be viable in all regards right now, but there may be other people who could be invited in, other moneyed people who could be invited in. I'd like to see other moneyed people step up and say, we want to help. And maybe this board perhaps is out of ideas right now, out of money and ideas, and maybe they should make room for others.
Yes, Kim.
When James mentioned earlier about the audience may not be there anymore, I mean, this poor city opera audience has had a rough couple of years. There was a year where the theater was completely dark and then very, very reduced seasons. Where there might be two operas in the fall. So by the time the public was aware the season was on, it was over. And if I may say, we touched on this earlier, some very uninviting marketing. I mean, whatever had become the brand, the black circle, was very off-putting. I mean, they did a revival of Elixir of Love this year, and the visual was a black fist with knuckle rings, you know, implying mafioso violence. Not very inviting. Interesting enough, they also had a delightful, charming, wonderful young star tenor, David Lomeli, who was not publicized at all. Now, in the past, City Opera's audience would have picked up on an emerging young artist and flocked, but they wouldn't have had two operas in which to do it. I actually don't think in the last 2 years that George Steele has been in management, I don't have as much a complaint of the quality of the work. I think there's actually been some very, very good work. It's more there just has not been enough of it, and it has not been varied enough. I think you can't do all cutting edge. I think you've got to have bread and butter. And I think there were audiences. I think there was an audience for Bohème at City Opera and Bohème at the Met. And sometimes they merged and sometimes they were different.
Oh, my God. If you think back to the era when I was singing there, sure, and I sang Liu and Turandot was done at the Met at the same time. But no one was saying, why is New York City Opera doing Turandot? And we had audiences. We did Bohème. I did Bohème there. And I later did Bohème at the Met. Butterfly was always done in both places. There was a cutting-edge Frank Corsaro production of Butterfly. So this is not an excuse, the type of repertoire. It is really the ideas behind how you present this repertoire.
Well, I mean, I will give George Steele credit for recognizing that in the time, you know, in the time since he's come here and the dark year before he came here, that the playing field has changed and that the strategy needs to change. That, in other words, the City Opera has to be reinvented, I guess is the word, into something different that will serve a different public, that, you know, there's a different public available today than what there was in, say, 2005. And I give him credit for recognizing that fact and for making an effort in that direction to try to understand what that public is and how to find that public. Whether this is going to be a successful experiment, I can't say.
As far as, could I just briefly add in fundraising, I don't know how strenuously the city has been approached yet. I honestly don't know. I know I just read about a new theater being built in Brooklyn for Shakespeare,
and
for tens of millions of dollars. So there is the possibility. I think also that would be needed, some large gift as well as small-scale grassroots. And I think people have been very reluctant to give any contribution to City Opera because they don't know what they're giving to at the moment. So I think
it was announced in the Wall Street Journal this morning that they got $1 million because of this announcement. So something came out of it. Somebody was listening to this. I guess the question.
Well, unfortunately, in opera, it's like the expression, a million here, a million there. Sooner or later, you're talking about real money.
Real money, yes.
Yeah.
It's true. Well, my question now is, at this point, is it a case of trying to bail out the Titanic?
You know, I think right now there's going to be a continuing discussion, I hope a meaningful dialogue between both sides, meaning the present management and the unions.
Will there be a strike over this, do you think?
Can there
be a strike?
That is hard to say at the moment, but I do think that they have put proposals to the chorus and the orchestra, and the proposals basically start at zero. And I think it's probably like trying to, let's say, start at the lowest possible point and then make concessions to the other side, but don't start too high because you want to meet somewhere in the middle. So it's a matter of whether these two sides can finally meet in the middle and whether the unions will feel that what they're being offered is enough to sustain their lives. Because what is going to happen to these people if they don't have any employment? And there's very little employment being offered to them.
Ken, I want to ask you, speaking of employment, you represent a lot of young singers.
Yes.
Where, if not City Opera, where do they have to sing?
Well, it's a tremendous, tremendous blow and a real loss because In the days when City Opera was doing full seasons, there was a lot of people employed. Many, many, many young artists that I represented and established artists were thrilled to make debuts and continue relationships at City Opera because of the history of the company and because it was at Lincoln Center. It was even the days when fees were very, very low, it was still Lincoln Center exposure, and that was invaluable. Where are they going to go? There's going to be more and more people unemployed. And yesterday I read a quote from management saying in the new offer they just thought that people should be paid for the amount of work they did. But I think this whole way of thinking, if it's smaller venues, they're going to be doing smaller operas, which means smaller or no choruses. So I think the whole thing is going to keep contracting, and that's a real concern.
I mean, I could point out this being paid for work done idea. One of the big successes so far of George Steele's tenure is Christopher Alden's production of Don Giovanni, done two seasons ago. But one thing about that production is that the chorus was on stage for the entire show acting, even though they have maybe 5 minutes of music to sing in the whole show. So the chorus really provided the whole visual, or a large part of the visual impact of that production, and really was part of the whole concept of that production. And the reason Alden was able to use the chorus that way was because they were being paid on a weekly basis. They were available for rehearsal. He could do that. If he's having to budget his show at how much is it going to cost per three-hour session to get the chorus in here to do staging, I don't think a director could ever approach his work that way. I think he'd have to come up with a completely different way to use the chorus that would be the most cost-effective way rather than the most artistically expressive way.
And also just to add to that, James, I completely agree. It also may have worked so well because that chorus was used to functioning as a chorus. In other words, they weren't all brought in freelance. They were an ensemble that had worked together over and over again. So that probably added to that experience as well.
I think that was the gist of, if one reads the letter that came from all of us as singers, and the signatories were not just the star singers of that began at New York City Opera. They also include some of the young singers who are singing today. So they stuck their neck out to sign this letter. Some others who were singing in the middle levels of the career, or as company members, weekly members. Others were, people from behind the scenes, dressers and so forth and so on. But the main thing that we were saying in that letter was it's not about Lincoln Center in the end. Would we love to stay at Lincoln Center as a group? Yes, of course. Who wants to leave a theater that has become our home for so many years, 45 years? And the real problem, though, is the fabric of the company now is being completely ripped apart, dismembered. And the fact is, the whole point of a company that can perform a Don Giovanni by Christopher Alden like he did, or when I did Saint of Bleecker Street with the chorus on stage most of the time, is it works really when you have a company that knows each other and works as an ensemble, the orchestra that knows the singers on stage, the chorus on stage, this idea of a pickup affair from performance to performance or production to production is not really going to be the best way unless you have lots of money to do lots of rehearsal with each pickup group.
Well, I was just thinking, a recent correlation is right now in New York, we have the Royal Shakespeare Company doing five productions, and they've rebuilt a theater in the Armory, so it's a new space for them, but it replicates their space. It's the company, it's all the actors, it's the whole support team performing five plays in repertory. So I would still go to that and feel that I'm seeing the Royal Shakespeare Company, where I might not if I'm seeing City Opera in five different venues.
James, you in your blog talk all the time about the public or the cher public. You kind of are the representative of the public. Are there still people there for the people's opera, or has the lack of music education in the schools kind of done in a large part of the opera-going public? I mean, not literally done them in, but
done in
the taste for opera.
Well, you know, again, this is actually something I was discussing with a colleague yesterday, and I think one big change between now and, say, the 1970s or earlier is that at that time, art in New York was a matter and a sense of if you present it, they will come. If there's good, interesting art being done somewhere in the city, you know, that you can get to on the IRT train, you know, people are going to come to it. Since that time, I think the change in our whole society has so strongly gone over to marketing and strong advertising of all kinds of product, of commercial product as well as art, that no matter how good the product you're presenting is, at the Metropolitan Opera, at the New York City Opera, at MoMA, at wherever, the public is not going to be interested unless it's marketed to them in a vital and exciting way that convinces them this is something you need to do rather than something else. This is something you need to take time out of your day to do. You're going to, you know, as my colleague was saying, you're going to feel like a schmuck if you don't go to see this. And that, I think, is, again, to give someone else credit, this is what Peter Gelb, I believe, has done at the Met, has positioned the Met as, on certain nights anyway, or for certain presentations, if you don't go to this, then you're going to really feel like a fool when you're talking to your friends.
But you're saying this is mainly a matter of marketing, because City Opera this year did do some things that on the face of it would have looked like, if they'd been marketed, the new Stephen Schwartz.
This is just the thing, is something like A Quiet Place, which is a difficult show to sell, but I think a very interesting and intriguing piece. I don't think anyone really sort of knew what it was about, what to expect, why it was important that they should take 3 hours out of their life to go to Lincoln Center and see it. I don't think anyone really had that idea.
I was amazed, actually, that Quiet Place did not do better, because I thought a major Bernstein piece premiering in New York in an excellent production, very well cast. I thought it made a great case for the piece. I was amazed that did not do better. But it is an interesting point about audiences, because in the days when Catherine was building her career there, there was such a vital audience and evolving company. I mean, the talent level was amazing. So we would go to see the novelties, the rare operas, but we'd also go to see the Bohems and Traviatas, because there were always interesting people that the public followed. I think we've lost that aspect. Catherine might do several roles in one season, and that's unheard of now. And the public would keep coming back. And unfortunately, I think we have lost that in general with opera. That has changed.
So I think that part of the game has changed, in that I don't think there is a sense that the company is there and the public is there for them. I think the company is there, and it's their job constantly to be attracting the public. They can't really let up on that at any time. And that, I believe, is kind of a failing at what we've seen at City Opera the last couple of years, is that sense of really aggressively and imaginatively marketing what is a really kind of unusual product that they're presenting. It's a little esoteric. It's a little bit off center what they're trying to get the public to come and see. And so they need a very interesting way of getting people interested in what they're doing.
On the flip side, the money side, what kind of contract now could they offer that would be viable for Catherine, your forces, Ken, for your artists you represent?
Well, as Ken mentioned, in the if I think about the what I was offered at New York City Opera in the beginning of my career, in that time, I would have to translate it to this time, but it wasn't a great deal of money, absolutely not. And most people singing at New York City Opera, of course, they want a decent fee that works in the time they're living in, but at the same time, that is not the, I don't think, always the primary reason why artists decide to sing at a company like New York City Opera. But we're going to have troubles right now because as long as we have had very strong unions, especially 802 with their orchestra, even stronger.
The musicians' union.
Yes. And IATSE, we're not even talking about the crew, the stage crew. You know, we haven't even discussed IATSE. They're much more secretive about all of this. But I'm sure they have a few aces up their sleeve, too, about all of this. You know, you can't just sort of...
And once again, though, I guess it all comes back to who's going to pay for it, because presumably these are going to be union contracts.
But they can also decide to look into why the funds suddenly dwindled. You know, I mean, there is probably going to be much more...
I gather it wasn't quite that sudden because they started tapping into the endowment.
Of course it wasn't. It started several years back, yeah. Exactly, when this whole Mortier situation started to come up. Mortier was a great idea. I admire that man tremendously.
That was trying to hire Gerard Mortier from Europe
exactly.
to come and...
But then that led to the closing down of the theater and the rebuilding and the renovating and so on and so forth. And there was a great deal of dipping into the endowment that was apparently allowed by the Attorney General, et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be a lot more coming out in legal terms. And between the union now and the company, they're going to have to decide what's going to happen, which singers are going to actually cross that so-called invisible picket line to sing at New York City Opera when most contracts, all contracts have been AGMA contracts for singers.
AGMA's the singers' union.
Yes, exactly. So how do we get around that? Who's going to be asked to sing for this company without the agreement with the unions? That's a big item right now, and we can't forget about that.
I'm almost feeling in these recent days that there's almost two New York City operas. There's the one that announced their plans yesterday and will go forward with the season, and then there's the company, the chorus, the orchestra, as it was. And it's strange. That's sort of which city opera are we talking about? But, you know—
Well, we can't be talking about the city opera of the past anymore, clearly.
But the past a few months ago.
Those people standing outside yesterday are not really the past.
No, I say a few months ago, because the present agreements lapsed at the end of April. They should have started negotiations before that. What I've heard from the people from all sides is that these negotiations were not carried out. And George Steele has made a statement that we are going to continue in good faith in negotiating. Actually, that hasn't even begun.
Well, of course, it all comes back to my question before about running an opera company on fumes. It's difficult to negotiate contracts with people if you have no money to pay them. So I guess my final question is, would another towering personality like Beverly Sills be able to save New York City Opera at this point?
I actually believe Beverly Sills, first of all, she would have had the passion to save City Opera, which I don't think is there. But I remember the days when we would schedule a meeting with her when I was representing an artist, and she'd say, you know, can we do it a day later? I have to fly off somewhere and raise $15 million tonight. And she'd come back the next morning with the $15 million. Now, she was one of a million kind of personality. But that kind of personality and that drive and passion are probably exactly what's needed right now.
Well, thank you very much. We will continue to watch this situation very carefully. That was Ken Benson, artist manager, who chimed in last there. We also heard from soprano Catherine Malfitano and blogger and New York Post correspondent James Jordan. I'm Naomi Lewin, and this has been a special podcast from WQXR Radio. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Such a pleasure, Naomi.